Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Imagine you're designing a workplace and work culture from the ground up. What could you do to make your employees comfortable but not complacent? The physical setup certainly matters. Good lighting, adequate space for both independent and collaborative work, even nice restrooms make a difference. And as my guest today will explain, employers who want to offer really excellent work environments would do well to pay attention to office culture and to empower their staffs to determine when, where, and how they are most innovative and productive. Psychologist Ron Friedman is founder of the workplace consulting firm Ignite 80. His new book is called The Best Place to Work: The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. Ron, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris.
So there was a time when building a successful enterprise was all about like achieving the utmost levels of efficiency. And I guess that's fine if your employees even today are assembling parts in a factory. But now all these jobs require people to be engaged to do their best work. And a significant majority of workers report they are not into their jobs.
That's right. In fact, that's part of the reason I called my company Ignite 80 is because Gallup research shows that over 80% of employees worldwide are disengaged at their work or at least not working up to their potential. And as it turns out, if you look at the science, there are some pretty clear things that any organization can apply to get their employees more engaged. And in fact, on the individual level, things that we can all do to make sure that we are more passionate about the work that we do.
You say that great workplaces reward failure. What do you mean by that, and how does that benefit companies?
It's interesting. You know, when you look at the companies and, in fact, the people who are most successful over the course of our history, whether it's people like Thomas Edison or people who are successful in athletics, people like Babe Ruth, Kobe Bryant, Brett Favre, they tend to have a higher failure rate than people who are less successful. And companies like Apple and Google, they have a long string of unsuccessful ventures. Even Google places, Google has products like Google Wave and Google Buzz that were just not very successful. And so rewarding failure is something that managers have found to help employees be more productive, in part because when you are less fearful of failure, you're more willing to take risks. And risk taking is critical, particularly if you're trying to get people to be creative.
So when failure is not an option, we end up focusing creative attention on avoiding mistakes rather than on innovating.
And on covering up mistakes when they happen. You know, it's one of the things I talk about in the book is research showing that people are more hesitant to admit to failures when they happen. And as a manager, that's a real problem when you have mistakes that are happening and people aren't reporting them because you can't make corrections. And so we're not talking about rewarding all types of failures. There are failures that are caused by inattention or lack of ability. Those are bad. You don't want those kinds of failures. But there are failures that are beneficial if you're looking to get people thinking creatively, like experimentation or intelligent risk-taking. So as a manager, what you want to do is look at the reason why the failure happened and then respond accordingly rather than just treating all failure as bad.
I suppose, though, it is easier for like a Google or a Babe Ruth to take some risks because they have these great reputations and everything else is firing on all cylinders. You have to be somewhat stable in what you're doing and have a modicum of success in order to reward failure, right?
I think that's true. And I also think that the critical thing is to mine failures for learning opportunities. You know, when you think about even, you know, this is far and away from the example of the workplace. But if you think about toddlers and how they learn to walk, it's by accepting the fact that they're going to fall down, that they're willing to take that risk of standing on their two feet and trying to move around. And you know, that's just kind of how we learn is being willing to take risks and then using the feedback we get to correct our behavior.
Your section on workplace design is so interesting. Something as simple as like ditching the acoustic tile that lowers the ceiling and raising that height can be helpful.
You know, there's so much evidence showing that our physical surroundings have a profound impact on our mindset. And the ceiling is just one example. There's evidence showing that there's a profound connection between space and innovation. So there's on the study of ceiling height, when we're in rooms with taller ceilings, we're better at abstract thinking. So we're better at connecting different thoughts together and coming up with more creative solutions. There's also research on color showing that when we're around the color red, we become more sensitive to failure. But when we're around the color green, we're more creative. And even things like furniture impact our attitude. So when you enter a room and the chairs are arranged in a circle, you're more focused on group belonging. But if you enter a room and the chairs are arranged at an angle, like they are at most conference rooms, we're more focused on expressing our individuality. So, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is that the layout of the room communicates the type of interaction that's expected, and then that shapes the mindset that ensues.
Ideally, an office gives people both a cave and a campfire for working in and around. Explain what that means.
So we have different personalities. Some of us are more extroverted and others are more introverted. And we work better in different environments. So we talk about the cave. We're talking about having a space that we can personalize that enables us to have some privacy and do focused work. But we also require campfires, rooms that are collaborative so that we can work together with others. And so the best office allows employees to have access to both types of environments rather than simply putting them in a single space and saying to employees, okay, this is the space that you have regardless of whether you're a marketer or an administrator or a new business person. We're going to give you a single space and it's up to you to figure out how to make this work. And so what I argue in the book is why not give employees a range of options, a space that they can personalize, but then also access to a thinking room, place where they can do some focused attention, and then a range of collaborative settings so that you can sit down with your colleagues without having to reserve a conference room.
It turns out to be pretty important that people have a little time for getting to know their coworkers as human beings. Tell us about why that matters.
Yeah, you know, when we feel connected to our colleagues in a meaningful way, we're a lot better at doing our job. And when we think about, typically when we think about colleagues, being friends with our colleagues, we think about all the negatives. We think about gossiping, or we think about favoritism, or we think about people fooling around. But as it turns out, when you look at the research, that's the wrong way of thinking about the impact of close colleague connections. We have a basic psychological need for relatedness. So when we feel like we're connecting with our colleagues, we feel recognized for the work and the contributions that we're providing. We take greater pride in our work. We're also more likely to point out to our colleagues if we feel close to them when they're off on the wrong path. And we're more willing to ask for help. All of those things make us a better employee when we feel connected. And there are so many things that employers can do to promote closer connections between colleagues that they're simply not doing. And I'll give you an example of a really easy one that really any organization can apply is when you have an employee who is about to join your company, don't just introduce them by their professional experience, but talk a little bit about their interest outside of the workplace. So, for example, here's Chris. She likes to bake cupcakes. She's really into the Dallas Cowboys. She has two kids who are in this school district. And what that does is that creates an opportunity for me, Chris, as your colleague, to talk to you about some things that aren't necessarily related to work. So now we have the ability to bond over personal matters. And oftentimes it's those close personal connections and similarities that set the stage for a closer friendship to develop.
And when that friendship develops, I will be more reluctant to let you down as my colleague, whereas I might not care about what my boss thinks.
It's, you know, it's one of those things that can really be a much stronger motivator than anything that a manager can say. Is now, if you and I are close friends and we're working together on a project, I might think twice about calling in sick because now I'm not just letting down my manager, I'm letting down my friend. So close colleague connections are a simple thing that any organizations can do, and it's not an expensive thing that can really lead to greater profitability down the road.
So hiring managers have to think a little bit about how well people fit into the sort of culture of an organization. Of course, that doesn't necessarily always mean that someone is the right fit for a job. So what do we need to consider when we think about how well someone appears to be able to fit in to the culture we've already built?
It's become really fashionable recently to hire people for cultural fit, and I think it's well-intentioned. The idea is we want to hire people who are going to get along with one another, and that's good if the work is simple or if you're in the very early stages of your company. So if the work is simple, you don't necessarily need people thinking outside of the box or coming up with creative solutions. Replicating personalities is a good thing because essentially everyone is on the same page and doing the same work. You don't really need a lot of new and innovative thoughts entering the equation. But if you are in a company that has a larger set of employees and you're further down the road, here you actually want some diversity because you want people introducing new ideas into the conversation because not only does that get your existing employees thinking about new ideas, but it also gets them to think about some of their central assumptions and ultimately leads to a better work product. So what I argue in the book is that we really need to think more carefully about the skill sets that people require rather than simply hiring them because they appear to have the right sort of personality.
How does natural light affect the way we work?
You know, this is one of the more surprising things that I discovered while doing the research for the book is that daylight is quite critical to our effectiveness at work. There's research showing that you can actually predict how satisfied people are with their job by the amount of sunlight that enters the workplace. And people are better at staying on task. They're more focused. And in part, it's a biological reason. When we're exposed to daylight, our body produces more serotonin, which puts us in a better mood. It gets our body producing more melatonin, which enables us to sleep at night, and it lowers our blood pressure. So we're more effective during the hours when we're at work as a function of having exposure to daylight. So if you're in an office environment where daylight's just not an option for you, one of the things I'd strongly urge you to consider is taking walking meetings during the day. Don't necessarily just rely on meeting with your colleagues in the conference room or in one another's offices, but schedule a 30-minute session where you can both walk, perhaps to a cafe. And oftentimes it'll make you more creative because now you're being exposed to a different environment and that gets you thinking differently as well.
There's been so much talk in recent years about, you know, kids needing recess at school. And I suppose the same thing, it doesn't really change just because we're 25 and have a job in an office somewhere.
It really doesn't. It, you know, for so many years, we have simply overestimated the degree to which our productivity is a function of effort. And taking breaks over the course of the day, I prefer to refer to them as intermissions. And this is something that you can actively put on your calendar. This is what I often encourage clients to do is put this on your calendar, perhaps from, say, 10:15 to 10:30, take a 50-minute break and walk away from your desk. And the benefits of that is that it creates greater psychological distance between you and the work you're doing, enabling you to find some new and innovative solutions. And oftentimes, the longer we pay attention to a particular task, the more our focus narrows. And so we end up missing the forest for the trees. But walking away can often lead you to find far better solutions. And if you think about, you know, when we come up with some of our best ideas, it's often in the 30 minutes we spend exercising after work or in the drive home, the commute home, or in the shower. And it's because it often comes in the time between thinking about a problem really, really hard and then taking a break.
That's interesting. And of course, those are also times when we are less likely to have a device in our hands.
Ah, that's an excellent point. I agree with that.
Ron Friedman is my guest. He's a psychologist and founder of the workplace consulting firm Ignite 80. His new book is called The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ron Friedman, a psychologist and founder of the workplace consulting firm Ignite 80. His new book is called The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Ron, give us your explanation for your position that companies ought to at least consider allowing their employees to sleep on the job.
Well, you know, we have a profound need for rest that's just as important for our health as any other biological need, like the need for food or going to the bathroom, and we often scoff at it. Now, I don't necessarily come out and say in the book we should let people nap on the jobs, but I do think that we should give some consideration and some credence really to the research showing that people are happier, they have better memory, they're more creative, they're able to soak up information a little bit better as a function of taking 20 to 30 minute naps. And in fact, there's research showing that when you are allowed to nap for 20 to 30 minutes, you're often as fresh as you are first thing in the morning. So if you're looking to get people who are effective all day long, there's an argument to be made for providing access to restoration rooms where people can go in and either take a nap or do some yoga or do some stretching. And what I would recommend is doing a little bit of experimentation with it. Perhaps take a room designated as the restoration room and try it out for 3 months. See if it works out. And you can survey your employees, get their feedback, see if it's something that they find valuable. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But rather than simply dismissing the idea that we need rest to perform at our best, why not try it out?
So years ago, I worked for a company that had some pretty progressive ideas about setting up a workplace where you could take breaks and be comfortable and all that. So they put in, I don't know, like foosball tables and pool tables. But I have to tell you, only about 3 employees out of hundreds dared to use them. So what does it take to actually let people know that things like this are there for being used?
Well, I think modeling the behaviors by managers is critical. Providing people with access to amenities isn't going to go very far if your managers aren't using them. And oftentimes the culture of an organization is defined not by the mission or vision statement that's on the company wall, but rather by the behaviors of the people at the top. And there are benefits to creating an atmosphere of play in the workplace, particularly if you're looking to get people coming up with creative solutions. So, you know, putting together having a foosball table or a ping pong table, that isn't necessarily going to lead to greater productivity unless you're looking to get people to be more creative. And if you actually are serious about promoting this playful atmosphere, then you've got to model the behaviors that you want people to stick to.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak on the phone with Sean in Richardson. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sam. This is Sean. And it was just interesting conversation. I was the author was talking about sunlight. And I had sometimes back I just read something in the internet and I just tried it in my workplace. Having plants in around the place I work, there is actually a study that was done to have at least a minimum of 300 leaves of plants, several plants, but there should be at least 300 leaves. What it does is it constantly purifies the place around you work. And I think, come to think of it, if you stay just touch 5 square feet of the place where you sit, that is the most of the time you spend in almost your lifetime, actually, if you think about it, if you work in the same place for several years. And that keeps purifying the air continuously, day and night, even in the weekends. And that is beneficial, and I have seen it, and I have plants in my workplace, and that is really beneficial.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about plants in the workplace, Ron?
I think it's one of those things that's easy to overlook and to really not take seriously if you're a manager. We have this idea that really our productivity is fundamentally a function of how much effort we put in, or this notion that we control how successful we are at work. But oftentimes it's those little things in our environment that can have a dramatic impact on our performance. And psychologists have found that reminders of nature, whether it's plants or access to a fireplace or even having a fishbowl on your desk, reminders of nature put us in a mindset that psychologists refer to as soft fascination, which is a relaxed psychological state that facilitates creativity. So when we're in that mindset that engages us but demands very little of our attention, that we often can let our minds drift and come up with more creative solutions. And in fact, there's research I talk about in The Best Place to Work on the impact of plants, where psychologists took a group of people, put half of them in a room that was filled with plants and half of them in a room that was devoid of plants. And what they found is that when people were around more plants, they were far better at coming up with more creative solutions and were better at performing on cognitive tasks.
Another workplace space that most companies overlook is the bathrooms. It turns out it's actually sort of nice to have a decent bathroom, even if people are meant to be in and out quickly.
Yeah, you know, it's always kind of surprised me. In a lot of corporate settings, you go to a bathroom and it's just the most drab-looking space in the workplace. It's almost like a reminder that the manager wants you to get back to your desk. And it's such an easy thing to do, is to spruce it up by, you know, you can have music in the bathroom. Why not have music, right? You can have all sorts of fun things that can be done to make the space more relaxing for people. And as we talked about, taking breaks is critical, but it's also oftentimes in many office environments, that's the only access to breaks you have. Not everybody's able to put an intermission on their calendar because they just don't have as much control as their manager does over their schedule, but they do have access to the trip to the bathroom. And it's in that moment when we disengage from thinking really hard about a problem that we're, again, more prone to coming up with creative solutions. And so if you are exposing people to new ideas on the way to the bathroom or in the bathroom, they can come up with more creative ideas. And one of the examples I give in the book is of Google, where they started posting new articles for coders on bathroom stalls. And it became a running joke about how when someone would say, I'm off to learn about coding, that would be code for I'm about to go to the bathroom. And it seems like kind of like a funny anecdote, but it also is an example of how you can send a message of the organization's priorities. Because here's an opportunity where people are encouraged to learn with every spare moment that they have. And it sends a signal that this is an organization where we take learning seriously, and we also want to make it convenient for you.
So that is maybe a one vote for multitasking.
Well, you know, it's in those moments where we've worked very hard and now we're relaxing that those creative solutions come. So what you encounter in those moments can often have a large impact on the solutions you offer.
We have an interesting tweet here from JP who says his in-laws own a small business and the family all works together. Any thoughts on workplace relationships with family?
That's interesting. I think that it's really important to get on the same page about the goals of the organizations. And I think when you're on the same page about what you're trying to achieve, then you can have a thoughtful discussion about how to implement some of the solutions that'll get you there. But oftentimes with family and with working with friends, there's often a different agenda that is impacting how well you work with one another. So I think getting together and talking about the mission and vision is really critical in those instances.
We all like to feel happy on the job at work. What can we learn? What do the people who actually are happy tend to have in common that the people who just kind of slog in there and get it done and leave don't?
Well, this is kind of a global statement I think that any organization can learn from, and that is what people want from their workplace is ultimately the same thing that they want in every other domain in life, and that's to have their basic human psychological needs met. And so if you're looking to create an organization that gets people happy and passionate about their work, you want to create opportunities for them to grow their competence on a consistent basis, not just feel good about the work that they do, but really giving them the opportunity to learn new things, connect them to their colleagues in a meaningful way. We will have a basic need for connectedness. And then provide them with opportunities for feeling autonomous, so feeling like they have choice in the way that they go about doing their work. When we have our basic psychological needs met, we tend to be happier, healthier, and more productive. And any organization can create those experiences, and there are some very specific things that they can do to approach each one.
So having psychological needs met is not something that people necessarily look to work for, but it turns out, I guess, that this is something that everybody should be paying attention to. Does that mean we need to, like, have different rules for different employees, or can this be done with sort of global policies within an organization?
I think there are global policies, and I think that it's something that more managers need to pay attention to, and it's why there's such a high rate of people being disengaged at work is not enough managers know about the science of what really leads people to be more satisfied, more productive at work. And I'll give you an example of something that just about any organization can do in an inexpensive way to get people learning new skills. One is to offer employees a reading budget. So, for example, you can offer every employee in your organization an opportunity to buy a new book that's in some way relevant to the work that they're doing once a quarter. And what that does is that exposes people to new ideas relevant to their job and creates opportunities for them to think about how they can incorporate some of the ideas. You can create an office library. You can create an office book club. And rather than just saying to every manager, you have to make sure your employees are learning new things, it creates an environment where learning is ongoing and people are constantly coming up with new ideas and new solutions and introducing them into the conversation.
So I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is that ideally work gets a little more challenging as we gain skills so that we are learning new things throughout the course of our careers. Can you talk about some of the ways that we can make sure this is happening?
Well, first, let me tell you about why I think that's so critical. Again, we talked about the importance of having competence building experiences, and that's critical. And a lot of organizations, the opposite trajectory is what happens. And so when we think about some of the experiences that really get us engaged, they tend to get harder over time, not easier. But at work, it's the opposite, where when you first arrive at a job, the first few months are really, really challenging. And then 1 year, 2 years, 3 years into it, the work starts oftentimes getting predictable. And that's not a recipe for engagement. So if you're an employee, what you can do to maintain some of those challenges is we talked about the idea of a reading budget. So if you're an employee, if the budget's not provided for you, is, thinking about ways that you can continue to learn new things on your own, whether it be buying new books or even taking the last 15 minutes of your lunch to scan industry blogs. That's another way of finding new ideas that you can incorporate into your job. And frankly, looking for new challenges on a constant basis. You know, it's not something we often associate with happiness on the job, but doing the same thing again and again is just not a method of finding your passion, but rather looking for new challenges and then trying to incorporate that into your job and approaching your manager and saying, look, here's some three things that I think I can learn to improve my performance on the job, and here's why I think it'll improve our business. Doing that in a proactive way, I think, is something more of us should think about doing.
Ron, what kind of praise actually serves to inspire good work?
Well, praise that is when feedback is provided immediately, that's one thing that more managers can learn from. Oftentimes, the feedback comes to us in 6 month or 12 month intervals in the form of an annual review. And that's not an effective tool because we need the feedback to be immediate in order for it to be impactful. The second thing is to have the praise be specific. So rather than saying, you know, good job on that interview, Chris, I might say, if I'm your manager, I might say, I really like the research that you put into question X, Y, and Z. And so when we have praise that is specific and immediate, we can use that information to improve our performance on the job and therefore grow our competence.
I was interested to read that little surprise rewards that employees are given might actually work better than the annual bonuses that a lot of companies give out and that people come to expect.
Right. Well, you know, when bonuses become something that happens every 12 months, then it becomes an expectation. And when it's an expectation, it's no longer a bonus, oftentimes it can feel like a punishment. So, for example, if you got a $5,000 bonus last year and this month you're getting this year you're getting $4,500, you feel like you've done something wrong. And so if you look at the research on what actually leads people to be happy, oftentimes it's surprises in the workplace that can be more effective. And as it turns out, more often than not, surprises in the workplaces tend to be negative. So it's a product that's being discontinued or someone's being let go. So using surprises as a tool in a positive way can be something intelligent and effective for more managers.
Do you have to fight that thing that people do where they say, well, it's nice that we have this bonus or this surprise, but, you know, I'd rather have more money. Like how do you couch these so that people don't wish that they had the cash in their pocket?
Well, the first thing you do is you pay people, a living wage. And I there's research, and I talk about this in the book. There's research showing that if you pay people a little bit more than the industry standard, they tend to repay that in the form of working harder. So on a financial level, there's a business case to be made for paying people not just the industry average, but a little bit more. Once they feel like they're getting paid fairly, and that, you know, obviously that serves as a signal for I'm respected as an individual by my employer, then it's those little things like surprises or the occasional bonus here and there that can be impactful. But ultimately, it has to start with paying people a living wage.
Is that when you're consulting with companies, do they get that right away or do they sort of blanch at that at first and then does it take them a while to come around to that idea?
I think, generally speaking, managers and CEOs are interested in some of these insights because they're backed by data. So if you can make the case to people and say, look, there's research on this and here's what the research says, then people are generally open to accepting the ideas and to trying them out and implementing them in ways that benefit their employees. And so this idea that employers are simply out to make the most money possible without caring about their employees, I don't think that we need to think about this as the alternative to that, where I'm arguing for let's treat everybody better and we can all be happier in our lives. Rather, I'm making the case that by applying the latest science, we can make organizations not only more successful, but more profitable as well.
Psychologist Ron Friedman is my guest. He is founder of the workplace consulting firm Ignite 80 and author of the book The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with psychologist Ron Friedman, founder of the workplace consulting firm Ignite 80 and author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Kenneth in Richardson. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Question for the author. I finished a research for a dissertation a couple of years ago on schools and specifically organizational aesthetics in schools. And, you know, when we talk about workplaces, we very rarely consider the fact that, you know, schools not only employ people, they're obviously, you know, pretty important in the community. The research that I did specifically was talking to teachers to ask them their opinions about how they felt that their schools looked, et cetera, et cetera. And I just kind of wanted to hear his feedback on that and how he considered the importance of not only, you know, keeping schools safe, but also keeping them beautiful.
Thanks for your call.
You know, I think more organizations can learn a lot from the way that schools are designed, where it's a lot of the instructors there, they have their classroom, but then they also have the break room that they can go to connect with their colleagues and do some of their quiet work when they need to. Schools offer access to cafeterias where people can bond with one another. And on a related point, I would say that college campuses offer a model that a lot of organizations can learn from, their learning institutions. But in fact, what are we trying to do in a lot of organizations today? We're trying to get employees to learn. And so that's why that setting of giving people that access to cafeterias and informal social spaces where they can connect to others, quiet spaces where they can do their focus work, and then a personal space where they can excel at their job. All of those settings can benefit the work that people do.
Here's an interesting email from Jackie who says, many years ago there was a study why nurses continued to smoke. It was the only way they could be excused for a break. Non-smokers got and took fewer breaks. That's an interesting argument, I guess, for the importance of giving people a little time.
No question. You know, when we outlawed smoking on the job and we got more education around the problem with smoking, we did away with the smoke break, and maybe we shouldn't have. You know, we talked about that psychological distance, but the other thing that breaks do is that when you sit back down at your desk, you have what psychologists refer to as goal reactivation. So you're forced to take a few minutes to think about, hey, what am I really trying to achieve here in the work that I'm doing? And again, the more time you spend doing a task, the more narrow your attention becomes. So taking a few moments to step away from your desk, maybe even reconnect with your colleagues by having a conversation about the football game or last night's episode of Downton Abbey, all those things can make you better at your job.
Your book addressed something that I haven't seen in a lot of other places, and that is that as we move on in our careers and take on additional responsibility, our approach to our work and the things that make us the best employee possible at that level are different over time.
Can you say more about the specific idea?
Yeah, essentially, when you first start out, having your hands on every single detail is really important. And as you move on, you have to delegate responsibility in order to really be the best person possible at a particular level within an organization.
Ah, yes, that's right. You know, and it's an argument for disconnecting from work after hours. You know, being a good employee is no longer simply about what we do between the hours of 9 and 5. Oftentimes, the way we treat our bodies and our minds after work can help position us to be more effective. And when you're at a lower level, you're responsible for all of the details. And it's in that stage of work where more hours translates into better outcomes oftentimes, because you have a very clear sense on the things that you need to do. But as you get a little bit older and you become a little bit more mature and you start delegating work and becoming a manager, now your mood becomes a lot more critical to how effective you are, because interpersonal relations are in large part what you're in charge of doing on your job. And so by providing yourself with the opportunities to restock your mental energy after hours, that'll put you in a better mood during work hours, thereby making you more effective.
How should companies make the decision, where it's appropriate, about whether to insist that their employees come in and work in the office much of the time, or whether they have the latitude to work anywhere that works for them?
I think it's a decision that needs to be based on the specifics of that industry, the work that they're trying to get people to do. But I think they can certainly make more informed decisions to the extent that they look at some of the research on this. So there's studies showing that people tend to be a lot more productive and a lot more loyal to their company to the extent that they have greater flexibility over when and where to do their work. In part, it's because we have that psychological need for autonomy. So when we feel like we have freedom over how and where and when we do our work, we tend to be more engaged in doing that work. But also because it gives people the freedom to figure out what their best hours are for working on a particular task and then working only those hours. So oftentimes what happens in a lot of organizations is people are required to work between the hours of 9 and 5 and really just sit at their desk and man their stations, right, like a factory.
Right.
But their best hours are perhaps, for most people anyway, are between 9 and 12, and then they go to lunch, and then their productivity dips, and that's when they start cyberloafing. That's when they start going on Facebook and going on Amazon and Twitter, and it looks like they're working, but really, they're not really getting their best work done. And so what ends up happening is they have to work after hours, or they have to come in early, or they have to work over the weekends. Far better, I would argue, to the extent that it's possible, to give employees the flexibility to figure out how best to perform their job and say, here are the outcomes we are looking for, and it's up to you to figure out the process. And we'll have, you know, whether it be weekly or daily meetings to chart some of that progress. But really, you're an adult. We've hired you because we have confidence that you have the right skills and the right motivation. And we're going to trust you to figure out your best way of working. I would argue that's a far better recipe than simply requiring people to sit in an office for 40 hours a week.
So it would seem like some organizations worry that people who are allowed to work independently from home won't do enough work. I wonder if they should also be concerned about people who work from home and can never completely shut down because they've been allowed to work, you know, from the house. They think they should be answering email at midnight and that sort of thing.
I think you're going to see a lot more organizations being far more concerned about the latter in the future than the former. And in fact, we are starting to see more and more companies working to limit the amount of work people can do. So companies like Volkswagen now have started shutting down their email servers after work hours. Companies like Daimler, it's another auto manufacturer in Germany, when people go on vacation, there's a setting that prevents people from reaching them during vacation. And so when you come back from your vacation, you come back to it an empty inbox. There's a company in the book called Full Contact, which is a Denver, Colorado software company that has started rewarding employees with a $7,500 bonus if they can take a vacation without doing any work and not check their emails. And I think the reason you're starting to see more and more companies going in this direction is because they are looking at the data and starting to realize that if you want people to be engaged over the long term, not just producing over the next week or the next month, you need to give them those opportunities to restock their mental energy because it enables them to focus better when they're on the job.
How should managers cope with disagreements between their employees that crop up in the workplace? How involved should they get?
Oh, well, I think that is a question that really depends on the particulars of the situation and the job. But what I would urge more managers to do is to listen more than they speak. Oftentimes we, as managers, can think that we know best or that we have the best solutions. But in fact, listening to your employees and approaching them with an attitude of curiosity can ultimately benefit you in the long term.
For companies that would like to make some of these changes, even to physical workspaces, but don't necessarily, you know, have the budget to move to a new space or to re-outfit everybody's area, what are some things that they can do that are not that expensive?
Well, we talked about growing people's competence, and we talked about the reading budget, encouraging people to scan industry blogs. Another thing to, in terms of growing people's competence, is inviting them to identify some courses that they can take to grow their skill set. So that's on the area of competence, on the area of growing people's connections with one another. We talked about introducing people by some of their personal interests outside of the workplace, but also funding after work activities so that people can connect with one another over activities that they find inherently interesting. So, for example, creating an office band or funding the office volleyball team. But rather than dictating to employees, here are the things that we would like you to do. Like, for example, it's Wednesday at 4 o'clock, so we're all going to stop our work and do yoga together, which could be really awkward for people who don't like yoga.
Right.
Invite your employees to suggest activities that they're personally interested in. And then if you have 3 or 4 or 5 people who are interested in them, provide some of that seed money for after-work activities so that people can connect with one another after work. And on autonomy, we all have that basic need for feeling like we have choice in the way that we do our work. I think there's a lot of training that can be done for managers in terms of providing a rationale when a task is first presented so that employees understand why the work they're about to do is going to lend value to the organization. Oftentimes, when for managers, they kind of assume that their employees have the same level of understanding around why they're doing the task as they do, but that's just not the case because they're just not privy to the same information. They're not in the same meetings. Providing a rationale is critical. And the other thing, again, is offering employees opportunity to figure out what the process is. And rather than saying to them, here's how I want you to spend your time every Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, here are the goals. Say, here are the goals, and I invite you to figure out what the process is, and let's talk about it together and figure out the best way of working.
So, Ron, if you're a nurse or a firefighter or a teacher or certain other professions, it's you know, sort of comes with the job that you know what the meaning is of what you're doing. For other jobs where it's not so evident, what can we do to create workplaces that are conducive to the people who work there feeling as if their work has real meaning?
A simple thing that any organization can do is find the end user who is benefiting from the work that's being done by the organization and arrange an opportunity for your employees to meet that person and to hear about how your product or whatever it is you're producing, how it's impacting that person's life. And there's research showing that when people have that opportunity to meet with the end user, they tend to be a lot more motivated. And in part, it's because they feel like now the work that they're doing has some real meaning.
Some people go into job interviews and they just interview really well, and that may mean that they're beautiful workers as well. Sometimes it doesn't mean that. Any thoughts for really evaluating someone's potential when you might only have an hour sitting with them to figure this out?
Absolutely. You know, when you look at the data, it turns out in-person interviews are a fairly terrible technique for predicting whether or not someone is going to be effective in their job, in large part because these interviews are often largely disconnected from the work that person is actually going to be doing. So being really good interpersonally is a really good sign if you're about to hire a salesperson. But if you're about to hire a web designer or someone who's doing something that is very technical, that information that you're getting from that in-person interview isn't all that predictive of the work they'll be doing. The other thing is, there's research showing that over 80% of people lie during an in-person interview. So the information you're getting is really suspect. And finally, even if the information you were getting was completely on track with the work that person's going to be doing, and you're getting completely truthful answers, there are still reasons to doubt in-person interviews, and it's because we have all of these unconscious biases in the way that we interpret people's behavior and the way their appearance, and that then leads us to ask questions that are confirming of the suspicions that we have. So, for example, if you're interviewing someone who's good-looking, you tend to view them as more competent than they actually are. If you're interviewing someone who is really tall, you tend to view them as having greater leadership ability than they actually do. And if you're interviewing someone with a deeper voice, you tend to view them as being more trustworthy than they actually are. None of those things are true, but then they impact the questions that we ask. So, for example, if I view someone as being really extroverted, I might say, tell me about your experiences leading groups. But if that a candidate is introverted, I might say, are you comfortable being in front of a group? Now, both of those kind of get at the same information, but those small, subtle changes in the way I've asked the question lead the candidate to answer in a way that's confirming of my suspicions. So what I argue in the book is rather than simply relying on in-person interviews, have them create a job-relevant audition that allows you to see how that person does the job you're actually hiring them to do. So, for example, if you're hiring a salesperson, bring that person in and have them sell you on your company.
Psychologist Ron Friedman is founder of the workplace consulting firm Ignite 80. His new book is The Best Place to Work: The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. Ron, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.